Great rivers are between, and fearful floods, mightiest of all the ocean stream, not to be crossed on foot, but only on a strong-built ship. Are you but now come here upon your way from Troy, wandering a long time with your ship and crew? Have you not been in Ithaca, nor seen your wife at home? So she spoke, and answering her, said I, My mother, need brought me to the house of Hades, here to consult the spirit of Tiresias of Thebes. I have not yet been near Achaea, nor once set foot upon my land, but have been always wandering and meeting sorrow since the first day I followed royal Agamemnon to Ilius, famed for horses, to fight the Trojans there. But now declare me this, and plainly tell, what doom of death that lays men low overwhelmed you? Some long disease? Or did the huntress Artemis attack and slay you with her gentle arrows? And tell me of my father and the son I left. Still in their keeping are my honors? Or does at last an alien hold them, while my people say that I shall come no more? Tell me, moreover, of my wedded wife, her purposes and thoughts. Is she abiding by her child, or keeping all in safety? Or was she finally married by some chief of the Achaeans? So I spoke, and straight my honored mother answered, Indeed, she stays with patient heart within your hall, and wearily the nights and days are wasted with her tears. Nobody yet holds your fair honors. In peace Telemachus farms your estate, and sits at equal feasts where it befits the lawgiver to be a guest, for all give him a welcome. Your father stays among the fields, and comes to town no more. Bed has he none, bedstead, nor robes, nor bright-hued rugs. But through the winter he sleeps in the house where servants sleep, and in the dust beside the fire, and wears upon his body sorry clothes. Then when the summer comes, and fruitful autumn, wherever he may be about his slope of vineyard ground, a bed is piled of leaves fallen on the earth. There lies he in distress, woe waxing strong within, longing for your return, and hard old age comes on. Even so, I also died and met my doom. Not that at home the sure-eyed huntress attacked and slew me with her gentle arrows, nor did a sickness come, which oftentimes by sad decay steals from the limbs the life. But longing for you, your wise ways, glorious Odysseus, and your tenderness took joyous life away. As she thus spoke, I yearned, though in my mind hesitated, to clasp the spirit of my mother, even though dead. Three times the impulse came. My heart urged me to clasp her. Three times out of my arms, like a shadow or a dream, she flitted, and the sharp pain about my heart grew only more, and speaking in winged words, I said, My mother, why not stay for me, who long to clasp you, so that in the very house of Hades, throwing our arms round one another, we too may take our fill of piercing grief? Or is it a phantom high Persephone has sent, to make me weep and sorrow more? So I spoke, and straight my honored mother answered, Ah, my own child, beyond all men ill-fated! In no wise is Persephone, daughter of Zeus, beguiling you, but this is the way with mortals when they die. The sinews then no longer hold the flesh and bones together. For these the strong force of the blazing fire destroys, when once the life leaves the white bones, and like a dream the spirit flies away. Nay, now press quickly on into the light, and of all this take heed to tell your wife hereafter. So we held converse there, but now the women came, for high Persephone had sent them, who were great men's wives and daughters. Round the dark blood in throngs they gathered, and I considered how to question each. Then to my mind this seemed the wisest way. I drew my keen-edged blade from my stout thigh, and did not let them all at once drink the dark blood, but one by one they came, and each declared her lineage, and I questioned all. There I saw Tyro first, of noble ancestry, who told of being sprung from gentle Salmonius, told how she was the wife of Cretheus, son of Aeolus. She loved a river god, divine Enipus, who flows the fairest of all streams on earth. So she would walk by the fair currents of Enipus. And in his guise the land-shaker who girds the land met her at the outpouring of the eddying stream. The heaving water compassed them, high as a hill and arching, and hid the god and mortal woman. He touched the maiden, and she fell asleep. Then, on departing, he took her hand and spoke and thus addressed her. Be happy, lady, in my love. In the revolving year you shall bear noble children, for the love of the immortals is not barren. Rear them yourself, and cherish them. And now go home. Hold fast, and speak it not. I am Poseidon, the shaker of the land. So saying, he plunged into the surging sea. She then bore Peleus and Neleus, who both became strong ministers of mighty Zeus. Peleus dwelt in the open country of Iolcus, rich in flocks, the other at sandy Pylos, and sons to Crethus, also this queen of women bore, Aeson, Amphires, and Amythaon, the charioteer. And after her I saw Antiope, Asopus' daughter, who boasted she had been the spouse of Zeus himself. To him she bore two sons, Amphion and Zethus, who first laid the foundations of seven-gated Thebes and fortified it. Because unfortified they could not dwell in open Thebes, for all their power. And after her I saw Alcmene, wife of Amphitryon, her who bore dauntless Hercules, the lion-hearted, as the spouse of mighty Zeus, and Megara, harsh Creon's daughter, whom the tireless son of Amphitryon took to wife. The mother of Oedipus I saw, fair Epicaste, who did a monstrous deed through ignorance of heart in marrying her son. He, having slain his father, married her, and soon the gods made the thing known to men. In pain at pleasant Thebes, he governed the Cadmeans through the gods' destroying purpose. And she went down to Hades, the strong jailer, fastening a fatal noose to the high rafter, abandoned to her grief. To him she left the many woes which the avengers of a mother bring. Beautiful Chloris, too, I saw, whom Neleus once married for her beauty, after making countless gifts, the youngest daughter of that Amphion, son of Iasus, who once held sway at Minyan or Cumanus. She was the queen of Pylos, and bore Neleus famous children, Nestor and Chromius, and Periclymenus the headstrong. And beside these she bore that stately Pyrrho, the marvel of mankind, whom all her neighbors wooed. But to none would Neleus give her, save to him who should drive from Phylace the crook-horned, broad-browed kine of haughty Iphiclus, and dangerous kine were they. A blameless seer alone would undertake to drive them, but cruel doom of God prevented, harsh bonds and clownish herdsmen. Yet after days and months were spent, as the year rolled and other seasons came, then haughty Iphiclus released him on his telling all the oracles. The will of Zeus was done. Leda I saw, the wife of Tyndarus, who bore to Tyndarus two stalwart sons, Castor the horseman, and Polydeuces, good at boxing. These in a kind of life the nourishing earth now holds, and even beneath the ground they have from Zeus the boon that today they be alive, tomorrow dead, and they are allotted honors like the gods. Iphimedeia I saw, wife of Alois, who said she had been once loved by Poseidon. She bore two children, but short-lived they proved. Otus the godlike, and the far-famed Ephialtes, whom the fruitful earth made grow to be the tallest and most beautiful of men, after renowned Orion. For at 9 years they were 9 cubits broad, and in height they reached 9 fathoms. Therefore they even treated the immortals with raising on Olympus the din of furious war. Asa they strove to set upon Olympus, and upon Asa leafy Pelion, so that the heavens might be scaled. And this they would have done, had they but reached their period of full vigor, but the son of Zeus, whom fair-haired Leto bore, destroyed them both, before below their temples the downy hair had sprung and covered their chins with the fresh beard. Phaedra and Procris, too, I saw, and beautiful Ariadne, daughter of the wizard Minos, whom Theseus tried to bring from Crete to the slopes of sacred Athens. but he gained naught thereby. Before she came, Artemis slew her in sea-girt Dia, prompted by the report of Dionysus. Myra and Clemene I saw, and odious Eriphyle, who took a bribe of gold as the price of her own husband. But all I cannot tell, nor even name the many heroes' wives and daughters whom I saw, ere that the immortal night would wear away. Already it is time to sleep, at the swift ship among my crew, or here. My journey hence rest with the gods and you. As thus he ended, all were hushed to silence, held by the spell throughout the dusky hall. White-armed Arete was the first to speak. Phaeacians, how seems to you this man in beauty, height, and balanced mind within? My guest, indeed, he is, but each one shares the honor. Be not in haste, then, to dismiss him, nor stint your gifts to one so much in need. By favor of the gods, great wealth is in your houses. Then also spoke the old lord Echeneus, who was the oldest of Phaeacian men. My friends, not wide of the mark, nor of her reputation, speaks the wise queen. Therefore give heed. Yet word and work rest with Alcinous here. Then answered him Alcinous, and said, Even as she speaks, that word shall be, if I be now the living lord of o'er-loving Phaeacians. But let our guest, however much he longs for home, consent to stay, at all events until tomorrow, till I shall make our gift complete. To send him hence shall be the charge of all, especially of me, for power within this land rests here. Then wise Odysseus answered him and said, Mighty Alcinous, renowned of all, if you should bid me stay a year and then should send me forth, giving me splendid gifts, that is what I would choose. For much more to my profit would it be with fuller hands to reach my native land. Then should I be regarded more and welcomed more by all who saw me coming home to Ithaca. Then answered him Alcinous and said, Odysseus, we judge you by your looks to be no cheat or thief. Though many are the men the dark earth breeds and scatters far and wide who fashion falsehoods out of what no man can see, but you have a grace of word and a noble mind within, and you told your tale as skilfully as if you were a bard, relating all the Argives and your own sore troubles. But now, declare me this, and plainly tell. Did you see any of the godlike comrades who went with you to Ilius, and there met doom? The night is very long, yes, vastly long. The hour for sleeping at the hall is not yet come. Tell me the wondrous story. I could be well content till sacred dawn, if you were willing in the hall to tell us of your woes. Then wise Odysseus answered him and said, Lord Alcinous, renowned of all, there is a time for stories and a time for sleep. Yet, if you wish to listen longer, I would not shrink from telling tales more pitiful than these, the woes of my companions who died in aftertime, the men who escaped the grievous war cry of the Trojans, to die on their return through a wicked woman's will. Well then, chaste Persephone had scattered here and there those spirits of tender women. There came the spirit of Agamemnon, son of Atreus, sorrowing. Around thronged other spirits of men who by his side had died in the house of Aegisthus, and there had met their doom. He knew me as soon as he had drunk of the dark blood, and then he cried aloud and let the big tears fall, and stretched his hands forth eagerly to grasp me. But no, there was no strength or vigor left, such as was once within his supple limbs. I wept to see him, and I pitied him from my heart, and speaking in winged words, I said, Great son of Atreus, Agamemnon, lord of men, what doom of death that lays men low overwhelmed you? Was it on shipboard that Poseidon smote you, raising unwelcome blasts of cruel wind? Or did fierce men destroy you on the land, while you were cutting off their kine, or their fair flocks of sheep, or while you fought to win their town and carry off their women? So I spoke, and straightway, answering me, said he, No, high-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, on shipboard Poseidon did not smite me, raising unwelcome blasts of cruel wind, nor did fierce men destroy me on the land. It was Aegisthus, plotting death and doom, who slew me, aided by my accursed wife, when he had bidden me home and had me at the feast, even as one cuts the ox down at his stall. So thus I died a lamentable death, and all my men, with no escape, were slain around me. Like white-toothed swine at some rich, powerful man's wedding, or banquet, or gay festival. You have yourself been present at the death of many men, men slain in single combat, and in the press of war. Yet here you would have felt your heart most touched with pity, to see how round the mixing-bowl, and by the loaded tables we lay about the hall, and all the pavement ran with blood. Saddest of all, I heard the cry of Priam's daughter, Cassandra, whom crafty Clytemnestra slew beside me. And I on the ground lifted my hands and clutched my sword in dying. But she, the brutal woman, turned away and did not deign, though I was going to the house of Hades, to draw with her hand my eyelids down and pressed my lips together. Ah, what can be more horrible and brutish than a woman when she admits into her thoughts such deeds as these, and what a shameless deed she plotted, to bring about the murder of the husband of her youth. I used to think how glad my coming home would be, even to my children and my slaves, but she, intent on such extremity of crime, brought shame upon herself and all of womankind who shall be born hereafter, even on well-doers too. So he spoke. And answering him, said I, "Alas, the house of Atreus, far-seeing Zeus, has sorely plagued with women's arts from the beginning. For Helen's sake, how many of us died, and Clytemnestra plotted for you while absent." So I spoke, and straightway answering me, said he, "Never be you then gentle to your wife, nor speak out all you really mean, but tell a part, and let a part be hid. And yet on you, Odysseus, no violent death shall ever fall from your wife's hand. For truly wise and of an understanding heart is the daughter of Icarius, heedful Penelope. As a young bride we left her on going to war. A child was at her breast, an infant then, who now perhaps sits in the ranks of men, and happy too. For his dear father coming home will see him, and he will meet his father with embrace as children should. But my wife did not let me feast my eyes upon my son. Before he came, she slew me. Nay, this I will say further, mark it well. By stealth, not openly, bring in your ship to shore, for there is no more faith in woman. But now declare me this, and plainly tell, if you hear my son is living still, at Orchomenus, perhaps, or sandy Pylos, or at the home of Menelaus in broad Sparta, for surely nowhere on earth has royal Orestes died." So he spoke, and answering him said I, "O son of Atreus, why question me of this? Whether he be alive or dead I do not know. To speak vain words is ill." In such sad words, talking with one another mournfully, we stood, letting the big tears fall. And now there came the spirit of Achilles, son of Peleus, and of Patroclus, too, of gallant Antilochus, and of Ajax, who was first in beauty and in stature of all the Danaans after the gallant son of Peleus. But the spirit of swift-footed Iasides knew me, and sorrowfully said in winged words, "High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, rash as you are, what will you undertake more desperate than this? How dared you come down hither to the house of Hades, where dwell the senseless dead, spectres of toil-worn men?" So he spoke, and answering him, said I, "Achilles, son of Peleus, foremost of the Achaeans, I came for consultation with Tiresias, hoping that he might give advice for reaching rugged Ithaca. I have not yet been near Achaea, nor once set foot upon my land, but have had constant trouble. Well, as for you, Achilles, no man was in the past more fortunate, nor in the future shall be. For formerly, during your life, we Argives gave you equal honor with the gods, and now you are a mighty lord among the dead when here. Then do not grieve at having died, Achilles." So I spoke, and straightway answering me, said he, "Mock not at death, glorious Odysseus. better to be the hireling of a stranger and serve a man of mean estate whose living is but small than be the ruler over all these dead and gone. Now tell me tales of my proud son, whether or not he followed to the war to be a leader. Tell what you know of gallant Peleus, whether he still has honor in the cities of the Myrmidons, or do they slight him now in Hellas and in Thia, because old age has touched his hands and feet. I am myself no longer in the sunlight to defend him, nor like what I once was when on the Trojan plain I routed a brave troop in succoring the Argives. If once like that I could but come, even for a little space, into my father's house, frightful should be my might and my resistless hands to any who are troubling him and keeping him from honor. So he spoke, and answering him said I, Indeed, of gallant Peleus I know nothing. But about your dear son Neoptolemus I will tell you all the truth as you desire. For it was I in my trim hollow ship who brought him from Cyrus to the mailed Achaeans. And when, encamped at Troy, we held a council, he was always the first to speak, and no word missed its mark. Godlike Nestor and I alone surpassed him. Moreover, on the Trojan plain, when we Achaeans battled, he never tarried in the throng, nor at the rallying place, but pressed before us all, yielding to none in courage. Many a man he slew in mortal combat. Fully I cannot tell, nor even name the host he slew in fighting for the Argives. But how he vanquished with his sword the son of Telephus, Eurypylus the hero. Many of that Cetean band fell with their leader, destroyed by woman's bribes. So goodly a man as he I never saw, save kingly Memnon. Then, when we entered the horse Epeus made, we chieftains of the Argives, and it lay all with me to shut or open our close ambush. Other captains and counsellors of the Danaans would wipe away a tear, and their limbs shook beneath them. But watching him, at no time did I see his fair skin pale, nor from his cheeks did he wipe tears away. Often he begged to leave the horse. He fingered his sword-hilt and his bronze-tipped spear, longing to vex the Trojans. Yet after we overthrew the lofty town of Priam, he took his share of spoil and an honorable prize, and went on board unharmed, not hit by brazen point nor wounded in close combat, as for the most part happens in war. Haphazard Ares rages. So I spoke, and the spirit of swift-footed Iasides departed with long strides across the field of Asphodel, pleased that I said his son was famous. But the other spirits of those dead and gone stood sadly there. Each asked for what he loved. Only the spirit of Ajax, son of Telamon, held aloof, still angry at the victory I gained in the contest at the ships for the armor of Achilles. The goddess mother of Achilles offered the prize, and the sons of the Trojans were the judges, they and Pallas Athena. Would I had never won in such a strife, since thus the earth closed round the head of Ajax, who in beauty and achievement surpassed all other Danaans save the gallant son of Peleus. To him I spoke in gentle words, and said, Ajax, son of gallant Telamon, will you not, even in death, forget your wrath about the accursed armor? To plague the Argives the gods gave it, since such a tower as you were lost thereby. For you, as for Achilles, son of Peleus, do we Achaeans mourn unceasingly. None was to blame but Zeus, who, fiercely hating all the host of Danaan spearmen, brought upon you this doom. Nay, king, draw near, that you may listen to our voice and hear our words. Abate your pride and haughty spirit. I spoke. He did not answer, but went his way after the other spirits of those dead and gone, on into Erebus. Yet then, despite his wrath, he should have spoken, or I had spoken to him, but that the heart within my breast wished to see other spirits of the dead. There I saw Minos, the illustrious son of Zeus, a golden scepter in his hand, administering justice to the dead from where he sat, while all around men called for judgment from the king, sitting and standing in the wide-doored hall of Hades. Next I marked huge Orion drive through the field of Asphodel, the game that in his life he slew on the lonely hills. He held a club of solid bronze that never can be broken. Antitius I saw, the son of far-famed Gaia, stretched on the plain. Across 9 roods he stretched. 2 vultures sat beside him, one upon either hand, and tore his liver, piercing the caul within. Yet with his hands he did not keep them off, for he did violence to Leto, the honored wife of Zeus, as she was going to Pytho, through pleasant Panopeus. Tantalus, too, I saw in grievous torment, and standing in a pool. It touched his chin. He strained for thirst, but could not take a drink, for as the old man bent, eager to drink, the water always was absorbed and disappeared, and at his feet the dark earth showed. God made it dry. Then leafy-crested trees drooped down their fruit, pears, pomegranates, apples with shining fruit, sweet figs and thrifty olives. But when the old man stretched his hand to take, a breeze would toss them toward the dusky clouds. And Sisyphus I saw in bitter pains, forcing a monstrous stone along with both his hands. Tugging with hand and foot, he pushed the stone upward along a hill. But when he thought to heave it on clean to the summit, a mighty power would turn it back, and so once more down to the ground the wicked stone would tumble. Again he strained to push it back. Sweat ran from off his limbs, and from his head a dust cloud arose. And next I marked the might of Hercules, his phantom form, for he himself is with the immortal gods, reveling at their feasts, wed to fair-ankled Hebe, child of great Zeus, and golden-sandaled Hera. Around him rose a clamor of the dead, like that of birds, fleeing always in terror, while he, like gloomy night, with his bare bow and arrow on the string, glared fearfully, as if forever shooting. Terrible was the baldric round his breast, a golden belt where marvelous devices had been wrought, bears and wild boars and fierce-eyed lions, struggles and fights, murders and blood-sheddings. Let the artificer design no more who once achieved that sword-belt by his art. Soon as he saw, he knew me, and sorrowfully said in winged words, "High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, so you, poor man, work out a cruel task such as I once endured when in the sunlight. I was the son of Cronion Zeus, yet I had pains unnumbered, for to one very far beneath me I was bound, and he imposed hard labors. He even sent me here to carry off the dog, for nothing he supposed could be a harder labor. I brought the dog up hence, and dragged him forth from Hades. Hermes was my guide, he and clear-eyed Athena." So saying, back he went to the house of Hades, while I still held my place, hoping there yet might come some other heroes who died long ago, and more of the men of old I might have seen as I desired. Theseus and Pirithous, famous children of the gods. But ere they came, myriads of the people of the dead gathered with awful cry. Pale terror seized me. I thought perhaps the gorgon head of some fell monster high Persephone might send out of the house of Hades. So turning to my ship, I called my crew to come on board and loose the cables. Quickly they came, took places at the pins, and down the ocean stream the flowing current bore us, with oarage first and then a pleasant breeze. Book 12. The Sirens, Scylla, Charybdis, and the Kine of the Sun. After our ship had left the current of the ocean stream, and come into the waters of the open sea, and to the island of Aeaea, where is the dwelling of the early dawn, its dancing ground and place of rising, as we ran in, we beached our ship among the sands, and forth we went ourselves upon the shore, where, falling fast asleep, we awaited sacred dawn. But when the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, I sent men forward to the house of Circe, to fetch the body of dead Elpenor. Then, hastily cutting logs, where the coast stood out most boldly, we buried him, in sadness, letting the big tears fall. After the dead was burned, and the armor of the dead man, we raised a mound, and dragged a stone upon it, and fixed on the mound's highest point his shapely oar. With all this, we were busied. Nevertheless, our coming from the house of Hades was not concealed from Circe. But quickly she arrayed herself and came to meet us. Her maids bore bread and stores of meat and ruddy sparkling wine. And standing in the midst of all, the heavenly goddess said, "Madman, who have gone down alive into the house of Hades, thus twice to meet with death while others die but once, come, eat this food and drink this wine here for today, and when tomorrow comes you shall set sail. I will myself point out the way and fully show you all, lest by unhappy lack of skill you be distressed on sea or land and suffer harm." So she spoke, and our high hearts assented. Thus all throughout the day till setting sun we sat and feasted on abundant meat and pleasant wine. And when the sun had set and darkness came, my men lay down to sleep by the ship's cables. But leading me by the hand apart from my good comrades, the goddess bade me sit, herself reclined beside me, and asked me for my story. So I related all the tale in its due order, and thus spoke potent Circe. "All this is ended now, but listen to what I say, and God himself shall help you to remember. First, you will meet the Sirens, who cast a spell on every man who goes their way. Whoso draws near unwarned and hears the Sirens' voices, by him no wife nor little child shall ever stand, glad at his coming home. For the Sirens cast a spell of penetrating song, sitting within a meadow. Nearby is a great heap of rotting human bones. Fragments of skin are shriveling on them. Therefore, sail on, and stop your comrades' ears with sweet wax kneaded soft, that none of the rest may hear. If you yourself will listen, see that they bind you hand and foot on the swift ship, upright against the mast block. Round it let the rope be wound, that so with pleasure you may hear the siren's song. But if you should entreat your men and bid them set you free, let them with still more fetters bind you fast. After your men have brought the ship past these, what is to be your course I will not fully say. Do you yourself ponder it in your heart. I will describe both ways. Along one route stand beetling cliffs, and on them roar the mighty waves of dark-eyed Amphitrite. The blessed gods call them the Wanderers. This way not even winged things can pass, no, not the gentle doves which bear ambrosia to Father Zeus. But one of them, the smooth rock, always draws away, though the father puts another in to fill the number. No ship of man ever escapes when once come hither. But in one common ruin planks of ships and sailors' bodies are swept by the sea waves and storms of deadly flame. The only coursing ship that ever passed this way was Argo, famed of all, when voyaging from Aeetes. But her the waves would soon have dashed on the great rocks, but Hera brought her through from love of Jason. By the other way, there are two crags, one reaching up to the broad heavens with its sharp peak. Clouds gather about it darkly and never float away. Light strikes its peak, neither in heat nor harvest. No mortal man could clamber up or down it, though 20 hands and feet were his, for the rock is smooth as it were polished. About the middle of the crag is a dim cave, facing the west, an Erebus, the very way where you must steer your rounded ship, glorious Odysseus. And from that rounded ship no lusty youth could with a bow-shot reach the hollow cave. Here Scylla dwells and utters hideous cries, her voice like that of a young dog, and she herself an evil monster. None can behold her and be glad, be it a god who meets her. 12 feet she has, and all misshapen, 6 necks exceeding long, on each a frightful head. In these 3 rows of teeth, stout and close-set, fraught with dark death. As far as the waist she has drawn down within the hollow cave, but she holds forth her heads outside the awful chasm and fishes there, spying around the crag for dolphins, dogfish, or whatever larger creature she may catch, such things as voiceful Amphitrite breeds by thousands. Never could sailors boast of passing her in safety, for with each head she takes a man, snatching him from the dark-bowed ship. The second crag is lower, you will see, Odysseus, and close beside the first, you well might shoot across. On it a fig tree stands, tall and in leafy bloom, underneath which divine Charybdis sucks the dark water down. For thrice a day she sends it up, and thrice she sucks it down, a fearful sight. May you not happen to be there when it goes down, for nobody could save you then from ill, not even the earth-shaker. But swiftly turn your course toward Scylla's crag, and speed the ship along, for surely it is better to miss six comrades from your ship than all together. So she spoke, and answering her, said I, Yet, goddess, tell me this in very truth. Might I not possibly escape from fell Charybdis, and then beat off that other when she assails my crew? So I spoke, and straight the heavenly goddess answered, Fool, hardy man, still bent on strife and struggle, will you not yield even to immortal gods? This is no mortal being, but an immortal woe, dire, hard, and fierce, and not to be fought down. Courage is nothing. Flight is best. For if you arm and linger by the rock, I fear that issuing forth once more she may attack you with her many heads and carry off as many men. Therefore with zeal speed on, and call on Force, the mother of this Scylla, who bore her for a bane to humankind. She will restrain her from a second onset. Next you will reach the island of Thrinacia, where in great numbers feed the kine and the sturdy flocks of the sun. Seven droves of kine, and just as many beautiful flocks of sheep, 50 in each. Of them no young are born, nor do they ever die. Goddesses are their shepherds, nymphs of fair hair, Phaethusa and Lampetia, whom to the exalted sun divine Neaera bore. These their potent mother bore, and reared, and sent them to the island of Thrinacia, to dwell afar and keep their father's flocks and crook-horned kine. If you leave these unharmed and heed your homeward way, you still may come to Ithaca, though you shall meet with hardship. But if you harm them, then I predict the loss of ship and crew, and even if you yourself escape, late shall you come, in evil plight, with loss of all your crew. Even as she spoke, the gold-throned morning came, and up the island the heavenly goddess went her way. I turned me toward my ship, and called my crew to come on board and loose the cables. Quickly they came, took places at the pins, and sitting in order smote the foaming water with their oars. And for our aid behind our dark-bowed ship came a fair wind to fill our sail, a welcome comrade, sent us by fair-haired Circe, the mighty goddess human of speech. When we had done our work at the several ropes about the ship, we sat us down, while wind and helmsman kept her steady. Now to my men with aching heart I said, My friends, it is not right for only one or two to know the oracles which Circe told, that heavenly goddess. Therefore I speak, that, knowing all, we so may die, or, fleeing death and doom, we may escape. She warns us, first, against the marvelous sirens, and bids us flee their voice in flowery meadow. Only myself she bade to hear their song, but bind me with galling cords to hold me firm, upright against the mast block. Round it let the rope be wound. And if I should entreat you, and bid you set me free, thereat with still more fetters bind me fast. Thus I, relating all my tale, talked with my comrades. Meanwhile our staunch ship swiftly neared the Siren's island. A fair wind swept her on. On a sudden the wind ceased. There came a breathless calm. Heaven hushed the waves. My comrades, rising, furled the sail, stowed it on board the hollow ship, then, sitting at their oars, whitened the water with the polished blades. But I, with my sharp sword, cut a great cake of wax into small bits, which I then kneaded in my sturdy hands. Soon the wax warmed, forced by the powerful pressure and by the rays of the exalted sun, the Lord of all. Then, one by one, I stopped the ears of all my crew. and on the deck they bound me hand and foot, upright against the mast block, round which they wound the rope. And sitting down they smote the foaming water with their oars. But when we were as far away as one can call, and driving swiftly onward, our speeding ship, as it drew near, did not escape the sirens, and thus they lifted up their penetrating voice. "Come hither, come, Odysseus, whom all praise, great glory of the Achaeans! Bring in your ship, and listen to our song! For none has ever passed us in a black-hulled ship, till from our lips he heard ecstatic song, then went his way rejoicing, and with larger knowledge. For we know all that on the plain of Troy Argives and Trojans suffered at the gods' behest. We know whatever happens on the bounteous earth." So spoke they, sending forth their glorious song, and my heart longed to listen. Knitting my brows, I signed my men to set me free, but bending forward, on they rode. And straightway Perimedes and Eurylochus arose and laid upon me still more cords and drew them tighter. Then, after passing by, when we could hear no more the siren's voice nor any singing, quickly my trusty crew removed the wax with which I stopped their ears and set me free from bondage. Soon after we left the island I observed a smoke. I saw high waves and heard a plunging sound. From the hands of my frightened men down fell the oars and splashed against the current. There the ship stayed, for there they worked the tapering oars no more. Along the ship I passed, inspiriting my men with cheering words, standing by each in turn. "Friends, hitherto we have not been untried in danger. Here is no greater danger than when the Cyclops penned us with brutal might in the deep cave. Yet out of that, through energy of mine, through will and wisdom, we escaped. These dangers, too, I think some day we shall remember. Come, then, and what I say, let us all follow. You, with your oars, strike the deep breakers of the sea, while sitting at the pins, and see if Zeus will set us free from present death and let us pass in safety. And, helmsman, these are my commands for you. Lay them to heart, for you control the rudders of our hollow ship. Keep the ship off that smoke and surf, and hug the crags, or else, before you know it, she may veer off that way, and you will bring us into danger." So I spoke, and my words they quickly heeded. But Scylla I did not name, that hopeless horror, for fear, through fright, my men might cease to row and huddle all together in the hold. I disregarded, too, the hard behest of Circe, when she had said I must by no means arm. Putting on my glittering armor and taking in my hands my two long spears, I went upon the ship's foredeck, for thence I looked for the first sight of Scylla of the rock, who brought my men disaster. Nowhere could I descry her. I tired my eyes with searching up and down the dusky cliff. So up the strait we sailed in sadness, for here lay Scylla and there divine Charybdis, fearfully sucked the sea-water down. Whenever she belched it forth, like a kettle in fierce flame, all would foam, swirling up, and overhead spray fell upon the tops of both the crags. But when she gulped the salt sea-water down, then all within seemed in a whirl. The rock around roared fearfully, and down below the bottom showed, dark with sand. Pale terror seized my men. On her we looked and feared to die. And now it was that Scylla snatched from the hollow ship six of my comrades, who were best in skill and strength. Turning my eyes toward my swift ship to seek my men, I saw their feet and hands already in the air as they were carried up. They screamed aloud and called my name for the last time in agony of heart. As when a fisher on a jutting rock with long rod throws a bait to lure the little fishes, casting into the deep the horn of stall-fed ox, then, catching a fish, flings it ashore writhing, even so were these drawn writhing up the rocks. There at her door she ate them, loudly shrieking and stretching forth their hands in mortal pangs toward me. That was the saddest sight my eyes have ever seen, in all my toils, searching the ocean pathways. Now after we had passed the rocks of dire Charybdis and of Scylla, straight we drew near the pleasant island of the god. Here were the goodly broad-browed kine and the many sturdy flocks of the exalted sun. While still at sea, on the black ship, I heard the lowing of stalled cattle and the bleat of sheep. And on my mind fell the words of the blind prophet Tiresias of Thebes and of Achaean Circe, who very strictly charged me to shun the island of the sun, the cheerer of mankind. So to my men with aching heart I said, "My suffering comrades, hearken to my words, that I may tell you of the warnings of Tiresias and Achaean Circe, who very strictly charged me to shun the island of the sun, the cheerer of mankind. For there our deadliest danger lay," she said. "Then, past the island, speed the black ship on her way." As I spoke thus, their very souls were crushed within them, and instantly Eurylochus, with surly words, made answer, "Headstrong are you, Odysseus, more than man's is your mettle, and your limbs never tire. And yet you must be made of nothing less than iron, not to allow your comrades, worn with fatigue and sleep, to land, though on this sea-girt island we might make once more a savory supper. Instead, just as we are, night falling fast, you bid us journey on and wander from the island over the misty deep. But in the night rough winds arise, fatal to vessels, and how could anyone escape from utter ruin if by some chance a sudden storm of wind should come, the south wind or the blustering west, which wreck ships oftentimes, heedless of sovereign gods? No, let us now obey the dark night's bidding. Let us prepare our supper and rest by the black ship. Tomorrow morning we will embark and sail the open sea." So spoke Eurylochus. The rest assented. And then I knew some god intended ill, and speaking in winged words I said, "Eurylochus, plainly you force me, since I am only one. But come, all swear me now a solemn oath, that if we find a herd of cattle or a great flock of sheep, none in mad wilfulness will slay a cow or sheep, but be content and eat the food immortal Circe gave." So I spoke, and they then took the oath which I required. And after they had sworn and ended all their oath, we moored our staunch ship in the rounded harbor near a fresh stream, and my companions left the ship and busily got supper. But after they had stayed desire for drink and food, then calling to remembrance their dear comrades, they wept for those whom Scylla ate, those whom she snatched from out the hollow ship. And as they wept, on them there came a pleasant sleep. Now when it was the third watch of the night, and the stars crossed the zenith, cloud-gathering Zeus sent forth a furious wind in a fierce tempest, and covered with his clouds both land and sea, night broke from the heaven. And when the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, we beached our ship, hauling her up into a hollow cave where there were pretty dancing grounds and haunts for nymphs. Then, holding a council, I said to all my men, "Friends, there is food and drink enough on the swift ship. Let us then spare the kine, for fear we come to harm, for these are the herds and sturdy flocks of a dread god, the sun, who all things oversees, all overhears." So I spoke, and their high hearts assented. But all that month incessant south winds blew. There came no wind except from east and south. So long as they had bread and ruddy wine, they spared the kine, because they loved their lives. But when the vessel's stores were now all spent, and roaming perforce they sought for game, for fish, for fowl, for what might come to hand, caught by their crooked hooks, and hunger pinched their bellies, then I departed by myself far up the island to beg the gods to show my homeward way. And when, by a walk across the island, I had escaped my crew, I washed my hands where there was shelter from the breeze and offered prayer to all the gods that hold Olympus. But they poured down sweet sleep upon my eyelids while Eurylochus began his evil counsel to my crew. "My suffering comrades, hearken to my words. Hateful is every form of death to wretched mortals, and yet to die by hunger, and so to meet one's doom, is the most pitiful of all. Come, then, and let us drive away the best of the sun's kine, and sacrifice them to the immortals who hold the open sky. And if we ever come to Ithaca, our native land, we will at once build a rich temple to the exalted sun, and put therein many fair offerings. If, then, the sun, wroth for his high-horned kine, seeks to destroy our ship, and other gods consent, for my part, I would rather, open-mouthed in the sea, give up my life at once, then slowly let it wear away here in this desert island. So spoke Eurylochus. The rest assented. Forthwith they drove away the best of the sun's kine out of the field close by. For not far from the dark-bowed ship the kine were grazing, crook-horned and beautiful and broad of brow. Round them they stood and prayed the gods, stripping the tender leaves from off a lofty oak, for they had no white barley on the well-benched ship. Then, after prayer, when they had cut the throats and flayed the kine, they cut away the thighs, wrapped them in fat in double layers, and placed raw flesh thereon. They had no wine to pour upon the blazing victims, but using water for libation, they roasted all the entrails. So after the thighs were burned and the inward parts were tasted, they sliced the rest and stuck it upon spits. And now the pleasant sleep fled from my eyelids. I hastened to the swift ship and the shore. But on my way, as I drew near to the curved ship, around me came the savory smell of fat. I groaned and called aloud to the immortal gods, O Father Zeus and all you other blessed gods that live forever, verily to my ruin you laid me in ruthless sleep, while my men left behind plotted a monstrous deed. Soon to the exalted sun came long-robed Lampetia, bearing him word that we had slain his kine, and straightway with an angry heart he thus invoked the immortals. O Father Zeus and all you other blessed gods that live forever, avenge me on the comrades of Laertes' son Odysseus, who insolently slew the kine in which I joy as I go forth into the starry sky, or as again toward earth I turn back from the sky. But if they do not make me fit atonement for the kine, I will go down to Hades and shine among the dead. Then answered him cloud-gathering Zeus, and said, O sun, do you shine on among the immortals, and on the fruitful fields of mortal men? Soon I will smite their swift ship with a gleaming bolt, and cleave it in pieces in the middle of the wine-dark sea. All this I heard from fair-haired Calypso, who said she heard it from the guide-god Hermes. Now when I came to the ship and to the sea, I chid my men, confronting each in turn. But no help could we find. The kine were dead already. Soon, too, the gods made prodigies appear. The skins would crawl, the spitted flesh, both roast and raw, would moan, and sounds came forth like those of kine. For 6 days afterwards my trusty comrades feasted, for they had driven away the best of the sun's kine. But when Zeus, the son of Cronus, brought the 7th day round, then the wind ceased to blow a gale, and we, in haste embarking, put forth on the open sea, setting our mast and hoisting the white sail. Nevertheless, when we had left the island and no other land appeared, but only sky and sea, the son of Cronus set a dark cloud over the hollow ship, and the deep gloomed below. The ship ran on for no long time, for soon a shrill west wind arose, blowing a heavy gale. The storm of wind snapped both the forestays of the mast. Back the mast fell, and all its gear lay scattered in the hold. At the ship's stern it struck the helmsman on the head, and crushed his skull all in an instant. Like a diver from the deck he dropped, and from his frame the strong life fled. Zeus at the same time thundered, hurling his bolt against the ship. She quivered in every part, struck by the bolt of Zeus, and filled with sulphur smoke. Out of the ship my comrades fell, and then, like sea-fowl, were borne by the side of the black ship along the waves. God cut them off from coming home. I myself paced the ship until the surge tore her ribs off the keel, which the waves then carried along dismantled. The mast broke at the keel, but to it clung the backstay made of oxhide. With this I bound the two together, keel and mast, and getting a seat on these, I drifted before the deadly winds. And now the west wind ceased to blow a gale, but soon the south wind came and brought me anguish that I must measure back my way to fell Charybdis. All night I drifted on, and with the sunrise I came to Scylla's crag and dire Charybdis. She, at that moment, sucked the salt sea water down, and when to the tall fig tree I was upward borne, I clutched and clung as a bat clings. Yet I could nowhere set my feet firmly down or climb the tree, for its roots were far away and out of reach, its branches, and these were long and large and overspread Charybdis. But steadily I clung, until she should disgorge my mast and keel. And, as I hoped, they came, though it was late. But at the hour one rises from the assembly for his supper, after deciding many quarrels of contentious men, then was it that the timbers came to light from out Charybdis. I let go feet and hands, and down I dropped by the long timbers, and getting a seat on these, rowed onward with my hands. But the Father of men and gods gave me no further sight of Scylla, or else I should not have escaped from utter ruin. Thence, for 9 days I drifted. On the 10th, at night, gods brought me to the island of Ogygia, where dwells Calypso, a fair-haired, powerful goddess, human of speech. She welcomed me and gave me care. Why tell the tale? It was but yesterday I told it in the hall to you and your good wife, and it is irksome to tell a plain-told tale a second time. Part 2. The Recovery of the Kingdom. Book 13. From Phaeacia to Ithaca. As he thus ended, all were hushed to silence, held by the spell throughout the dusky hall. At length, Alcinous, answering, said, "Odysseus, having crossed the brazen threshold of my high-roofed house, you shall be aided home with no more wanderings, be sure, long as you now have suffered. And this I say insistently to everybody here, to you who in my hall drink of the elder's sparkling wine and listen to the bard. You know that in a polished chest lie garments for the stranger, with rich wrought gold and all the other gifts which the Phaeacian counselors have brought him hither. But let us also, each man here, give a cauldron and large tripod. Then, gathering the cost among the people, we will repay ourselves. For one to give outright were hard indeed." So said Alcinous. And his saying pleased them, and now, desiring rest, they each departed homeward. But when the early rosy-fingered dawn appeared, they hastened to the ship and brought the gladdening bronze. Revered Alcinous, going himself aboard the vessel, stowed it all carefully beneath the benches, so that it might not incommode the crew upon the passage while they labored at the oars. Then to Alcinous' house they went and turned to feasting. In their behalf, revered Alcinous offered an ox to Zeus of the dark cloud, the son of Cronus, who is the lord of all. And having burned the thighs, they held a glorious feast and made them merry. Among them sang the sacred bard, Demodocus, beloved of all. Nevertheless, Odysseus would often turn his face toward the still shining sun, eager to see it setting, because he was impatient to be gone. As a man longs for supper whose pair of tawny oxen all day long have dragged the jointed plough through the fresh field, gladly for him the sunlight sinks and sends him home to supper, stiff are his knees for walking, so gladly for Odysseus sank the sun. Straightway he turned to the oar-loving Phaeacians, and speaking to Alcinous especially, he said, "Mighty Alcinous, renowned of all, pour a libation and send me safely forth. Fare you all well. All that my heart desired is ready, escort and friendly gifts, and may the gods of heaven make them a blessing. My true wife may I find on coming home, and dear ones safe. And you who stay, may you make glad your wedded wives and children. The gods bestow all happiness, and may no ill inhabit here." He spoke, and all approved, and bade send forth the stranger, for rightly had he spoken. Then said revered Alcinous to the page Pontonous, "Mix a bowl, and pass the wine to all within the hall, that with a prayer to Father Zeus we may send forth the stranger to his native land." He spoke. Pontonous stirred the cheering wine and served to all in turn. Then to the blessed gods who hold the open sky they poured libations where they sat. But royal Odysseus rose, placed in Arete's hand the double cup, and speaking in winged words he said, "Fare you well, queen, for all the years until old age and death, which visit all, shall come. I go my way. May you, within this home, enjoy your children, people, and Alcinous the king." So saying, royal Odysseus crossed the threshold. With him, revered Alcinous sent a page to show the way to the swift ship and to the shore. Arete, too, sent damsels after, one with the spotless robe and tunic, one to accompany the close-packed chest, and one bore bread and ready wine. Now when they came to the ship and to the sea, straight the tall seaman took the stores and laid them by within the hollow ship, even all the food and drink. Then for Odysseus they spread a rug and linen sheet on the hollow vessel's deck, so that he might sleep soundly there at the stern. And he himself embarked and laid him down in silence. The other men took places at the pins, each one in order, and loosed the cable from the perforated stone. But now, when, bending to their work, they tossed the water with their oars, upon Odysseus' lids deep slumber fell, sound and most pleasant, very like to death. And as, upon a plain, four harnessed stallions spring forward all together at the crack of whip, and lifting high their feet, speed swiftly on their way, even so the ship's stern lifted, while in her wake followed a huge upheaving wave of the resounding sea. Safely and steadily she ran. No circling hawk, swiftest of winged things, could keep beside her. Running thus rapidly, she cut the ocean waves, bearing a man of godlike wisdom, a man who had before met many griefs of heart, cleaving his way through wars of men and through the boisterous seas, yet here slept undisturbed, heedless of all he suffered. As that most brilliant star rose, which comes the surest herald of the light of early dawn, the sea-borne ship drew near the island. Now in the land of Ithaca there is a certain harbour sacred to Phorcys, the old man of the sea. Here two projecting jagged cliffs slope inward toward the harbour and break the heavy waves raised by wild winds without. Inside, without a cable, ride the well-benched ships when once they reach the roadstead. Just at the harbour's head a leafy olive stands, and near it a pleasant, darksome cave, sacred to nymphs called naiads. Within the cave are bowls and jars of stone, and here bees hive their honey. Long looms of stone are here, where nymphs weave purple robes, a marvel to behold. Here are ever-flowing springs. The cave has double doors, one to the north, accessible to men, one to the south, for gods. By this men do not pass. It is the immortals' entrance. Here they rode in, knowing the place of old. The ship ran up the shore full half her length by reason of her speed. So was she driven by her rower's arms. The men then left the timbered ship and came ashore, and straightway took Odysseus from the hollow ship, him and his linen sheet and bright-hued rug, and set him on the sand, still sunk in sleep. They also brought the treasure out, which the Phaeacian chiefs gave him at his departure, prompted by kind Athena, and laid it all together by an olive trunk, a little off the road, for fear, before Odysseus woke, some passer-by might harm it. Then they departed homeward. Nevertheless, the earth-shaker did not forget the threats with which at first he threatened great Odysseus. But thus he asked the purposes of Zeus. "O Father Zeus, no more shall I be honored among immortal gods, if mortal men, the people of Phaeacia, honor me not, though men of my own kin. For I had meant that through much hardship Odysseus should return. I never tried to cut him off from coming altogether, because you gave him once a promise and confirmed it with a nod. Yet these Phaeacians have borne him through the sea on their swift ship asleep, and set him down in Ithaca, and given him glorious gifts, such stores of bronze and gold and woven stuffs as Odysseus never would have won from Troy itself, had he returned unharmed with his due share of spoil. Then answered him cloud-gathering Zeus, and said, "For shame, wide-ruling land-shaker! What are you saying? The gods do not refuse you honor. Hard would it be to cast dishonor on our oldest and our best. And as to men, if any, led by pride and power, dishonors you, vengeance is yours and shall be ever. Do what you will, even all your heart's desire." Then earth-shaking Poseidon answered, "Soon would I do, dark-clouded one, all that you say, but that I ever dread and would avoid your wrath. Even now, this shapely ship of the Phaeacians, returning home from pilotage upon the misty sea, I would destroy, that they henceforth may hold aloof and cease to give men aid, and I would throw a lofty mound about their city." Then answered him cloud-gathering Zeus, and said, "Friend, this appears to me the better way. When all the people of the town look off and see her sailing, then turn her into stone close to the shore, yet like a swift ship still, that all the folk may marvel and throw a lofty mound about their city." And hearing this, earth-shaking Poseidon hastened to Scyria, where the Phaeacians live, and waited there. Then, as the sea-borne ship drew near, running full swiftly, the earth-shaker drew near her too, turned her to stone, and rooted her to the bottom, forcing her under with his outspread hand, and went his way. But in winged words to one another talked the Phaeacian oarsmen, notable men at sea. And glancing at his neighbor, a Phaeacian man would say, "Ah, who stopped the swift ship on the sea as she was running in? In full sight, too, she was." So they would say, but knew not how things were. And now Alcinous addressed them thus, "Ah, surely, then, the ancient oracles are come to pass, told by my father, who said Poseidon was displeased because we were safe guides for all mankind. And he averred the god one day would wreck a shapely ship of the Phaeacians, returning home from pilotage upon the misty sea, and so would throw a lofty mound about our city. That was the old man's tale, and now it all comes true. However, what I say, let us all follow. Stop piloting the men who come from time to time here to our city. And to Poseidon let us offer 12 choice bulls, that he may have compassion and so not throw a lofty mound about our city." He spoke, and all the people feared, and brought the bulls. And then to Lord Poseidon, standing around his altar, the captains and counselors of the Phaeacians offered prayer. Meanwhile, within his native land, royal Odysseus woke from sleep, and did not know the land from which he had been gone so long. For a goddess spread a cloud around, even Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus, that she might render him unknown, and herself tell him all, and that his wife, his townsfolk, and his friends might never know him until the suitors paid the price of all their lawless deeds. Thus, to its master, all the land looked strange. The footpaths stretching far away, the sheltered coves, steep rocks, and spreading trees. Rising, he stood and gazed upon his land, then groaned and smote his thighs with outspread hand, saying in anguish, "Alas, to what man's land am I come now? Lawless and savage are they, with no regard for right, or are they kind to strangers and reverent toward the gods? Where shall I leave my many goods, and whither shall I turn? Would these had stayed with the Phaeacians where they were, and I myself had found some other powerful prince who might have entertained me and sent me on my way. Now where to store my goods I do not know. Yet here I must not leave them to fall a prey to strangers. Not at all wise and just were the Phaeacian captains and counselors in bringing me to this strange shore. They promised they would carry me to far-seen Ithaca, but that they did not do. May Zeus, the god of suppliants, reward them. For over all men watches Zeus, chastising those who sin. However, let me count my goods and see that the Phaeacians took none away upon their hollow ship." So saying, he counted the beautiful tripods, the cauldrons, gold, and goodly woven stuffs, and none was lacking. Then, sighing for his native land, he paced the shore of the resounding sea in sadness. Near him, Athena drew, in form of a young shepherd, yet delicate as are the sons of kings. Doubled about her shoulders, she wore a fine-wrought mantle, under her shining feet her sandals, and in her hand a spear. To see her made Odysseus glad. He went to meet her, and speaking in winged words, he said, "Friend, since you are the first I find within this land, I bid you welcome, and hope you come with no ill will. Nay, save these goods, and save me too. I supplicate you as a god, and I approach your knees. And tell me truly this, that I may know full well, what land is this? What people? What sort of men dwell here? Is it a far-seen island, or a tongue of fertile mainland that stretches out to sea?" Then said to him the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, "You are simple, stranger, or come from far away to ask about this land. It's not quite so nameless. Many men know it well, men dwelling toward the east and rising sun, and those behind us also toward the darksome west. It is a rugged land, not fit for driving horses, yet not so very poor, though lacking plains. Grain grows abundantly, and wine as well. The showers are frequent, and the dews refreshing. Here is good pasturage for goats and cattle. Trees of all kinds are here, and never-failing springs. So, stranger, the name of Ithaca has gone as far as Troy, which is, they say, a long way from Achaea." She spoke, and glad was long-tried royal Odysseus, filled with delight over his native land through what was said by Pallas Athena, daughter of aegis-bearing Zeus. And speaking in winged words, he said, yet uttered not the truth, but turned his words awry, ever revolving in his breast some gainful purpose. "In lowland Crete I heard of Ithaca, far off beyond the sea, and now I reach it, I and these goods of mine. I left an equal portion to my children, and fled away from home, for I had killed the dear son of Idomeneus, Orsilochus the runner, who on the plains of Crete beat all us toiling men in speed of foot. The cause was this. He sought to cut me off from all the Trojan spoil, to gain which I bore grief of heart, cleaving my way through wars of men and through the boisterous seas. And all because I did not, as he wished, serve with his father in the land of Troy, but led my separate men. With a brazen spear I struck him as he was coming from his farm, and I was lying with a comrade near the road. A very dark night screened the sky. No man observed us. Secretly, I took his life. So after I had slain him with my brazen-pointed spear, I straightway sought a ship, asked aid of the proud Phoenicians, and gave them from my booty what they wished. I bade them take me on their ship and set me down at Pylos, or else at sacred Elis, where the Epeans rule. But stress of wind turned them aside, though much against their will. They meant no wrong, and missing our course, here we arrived last night. With much ado we rowed into the port, and gave no thought to supper, hungry although we were, but simply disembarking from the ship we all lay down. Then, weary as I was, sweet sleep came on me, and the Phoenicians, taking my treasure from the hollow ship, laid it upon the sands where I was lying, and they embarked and sailed away to stately Sidon. So I was left behind with aching heart. As he thus spoke, the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, smiled and patted him with her hand. Her form grew like a woman's, one fair and tall and skilled in dainty work, and speaking in winged words she said, "Prudent and wily must one be to overreach you in craft of any kind, even though it be a god who strives to match you. Bold, shifty, and insatiate of wiles, will you not now within your land cease from the false misleading tales which from the bottom of your heart you love? But let us talk no longer thus, both being versed in wiles. For you are far the best of men in plots and tales, and I of all the gods am famed for craft and wiles. And yet you did not know me, Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus, me who am ever near to guard you in all toil, me who have made you welcome to all Phaeacian folk. Now am I come to frame with you a scheme to hide the treasure which the Phaeacian chiefs, through my advice and prompting, gave you at setting forth. And I will tell you, too, what griefs you must endure within your stately house. Bear them because you must. Do not report to man or woman of them all that you are come from wandering, but silently receive all pains and bear men's buffets. Then wise Odysseus answered her and said, Hard is it, goddess, for a man, however wise he be, to know when you are near. You take all forms. I very well remember how kind to me you were when all we young Achaeans were in the war at Troy. But since we overthrew the lofty town of Priam, since we went away in ships and God dispersed the Achaeans, I never once have seen you, daughter of Zeus, nor known you to draw near my ship, protecting me from harm. Yet bearing ever in my breast a stricken heart, I wandered till the gods delivered me from ill, when in the rich land of the Phaeacians you cheered me by your words and led me to the city. Now I entreat you by your father's name, for I cannot think that I am come to far-seen Ithaca. No, I have strayed to some strange shore, and you, in mockery, I think, have told this tale to cheat me. But tell me, have I really reached my own dear land? Then answered him the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, Such thoughts as these are ever in your breast. Therefore I cannot leave you even in misfortune, because you are discreet, wary, and steadfast. For any other man, on coming back from wanderings, would eagerly have hastened home to see his wife and children. But you have no desire to know or hear of them till you have proved your wife, who, as of old, sits in your hall, and wearily the nights and days are wasted with her tears. But I, for my part, never doubted. I knew within my heart that you would come, though with the loss of all your men. But I did not wish to quarrel with Poseidon, my father's brother, who bore a grudge against you in his heart, angry because you blinded his dear son. Come then, and let me point you out the parts of Ithaca, that so you may believe. Here is the port of Phorcys, the old man of the sea. Here at the harbor's head the leafy olive, and near at hand the pleasant darksome cave sacred to nymphs called naiads. Here is the arching cavern, too, where oftentimes you made due sacrifices to the nymphs. And this is the wood-clad hill of Neriton. The goddess, speaking thus, scattered the cloud, and plain the land appeared. Then glad was long-tried royal Odysseus, and he exulted in his land, and kissed the bounteous earth, and straightway prayed the nymphs with outstretched hands. O Naiad nymphs, daughters of Zeus, I said I should not see you any more, yet now with loving prayers I give you greeting. Gifts will we also give, even as old, if the daughter of Zeus, our captain, graciously grants me life, and prospers my dear son. Then said to him the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, Be of good courage. Let not these things vex your mind. But in a corner of the monstrous cave let us lay by the goods instantly now, here to remain in safety. Then let us plan how all may turn out well. So saying, the goddess entered the darksome cave, and searched about the cave for hiding places. Odysseus, too, brought hither all he had, gold and enduring bronze and fair-wrought raiment, things given by the Phaeacians. All these were laid away with care, and at the entrance a stone was set by Pallas Athena, daughter of aegis-bearing Zeus. Then, sitting down at the foot of the sacred olive, they planned the death of the audacious suitors, and thus began the goddess, clear-eyed Athena. High-born son of Laertes, ready Odysseus, consider how to lay hands on the shameless suitors who for 3 years have held dominion in your hall, wooing your matchless wife and offering bridal gifts, while she, continually mourning at heart over your coming, gives hopes to all, has promises for each, and sends each messages. But her mind has a different purpose." Then wise Odysseus answered her and said, "Certainly, here at home, I too had met the evil fate of Agamemnon, son of Atreus, had you not, goddess, duly told me all. Come then, and frame a plot for me to win revenge. And do you stand beside me, inspiring hardy courage, even so as when we tore the shining crown from Troy. If you would stand as stoutly by me, clear-eyed one, then I would face 300 men, mated with you, dread goddess, with you for my strong aid." Then answered him the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, "I surely will be with you. You shall never be forgot when we begin the work. Some, too, I think, shall spatter with their blood and brains the spacious floor, some of these suitors who devour your living. But let me make you strange to all men's view. I will shrivel the fair flesh on your supple limbs, pluck from your head the yellow locks, and clothe you in such rags that they who see shall loathe the wearer. And I will blur your eyes, so beautiful before, that you may seem repulsive to all the suitors here, and even to your wife, and the son you left at home. But first seek out the swineherd, the keeper of your swine, for he is loyal, loving your son and steadfast Penelope. You will find him sitting by his swine. They feed along the Raven Crag, by the spring of Arethusa, eating the pleasant acorns and drinking the shaded water, a food which breeds abundant fat in swine. There wait, and sitting by his side, question him fully, while I go on to Sparta, the land of lovely women, to summon thence Telemachus, your son, Odysseus. He went to spacious Lacedaemon to visit Menelaus, hoping to learn if you were still alive." Then wise Odysseus answered her and said, "Why, knowing all, did you yourself not tell him? Must he too meet with sorrow roaming the barren sea while others eat his substance?" Then answered him the goddess, clear-eyed Athena, "Nay, let him not too much oppress your heart. I was myself his guide, and helped him win a noble name by going thither. He meets no hardship there, but sits at ease within the palace of the son of Atreus, with plenty all around. Young men indeed now lie in wait on their black ship, and seek to cut him off before he gains his native land. Yet this, I think, shall never be. Rather the earth shall cover some of the suitors who devour your living."